Freedom Train, your community resource podcast series. I'm your conductor, Joseph Ward, and always riding with me is my good man, Mr. Patrick Irving. The Freedom Train is sponsored by PAX Inc. That's PACTSINC. And PAX Inc. is a black advocacy organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org. And also, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to learn more about us and to hear the playbacks of our shows. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at _FreedomTrain. You can also subscribe to the Freedom Train podcast on iTunes and Google Play Music. Pat.
What up?
Post-Trump. Trump in the office, man. What is we going to do? That's the tone today.
I've been working on my cotton-picking hands, and I scared, boss.
I've been building boats so I can row back to Africa.
I'm on swim.
I'm fast. I got on my Aquaman drawers, so I'm fast. That's the tone today, man. That's the tone. I'm kind of glad we're having this show this day, because we need it, and we ain't even go. Waste time, because we have the good professor Carl Tone Jones back on the show with us today to discuss part two of the Independence Day Project. What's going on, Professor?
Hey, what's going on, brothers? I looked out and it was daytime, and we weren't in an internment camp, so I didn't see anybody riding around with shotguns on the back of a pickup truck. I didn't see anybody hanging nooses in my neighborhood, so all is well.
Hey, man, you know, I thought they said the bottom was going to fall out, so I don't know.
I guess we ought to wait for January 1.
We probably do.
Yeah, I would say so. But, you know, this whole situation with, in terms of the presidential race and in terms of our response in it, I think it's just perception, the perception of what happened presidentially. Now, we can speak about the local politics and what went down locally in terms of the Senate races and the congressional races, mm-hmm. and how those all went to red, you know, and created a lot of red states and control of the Congress. But in regards to the overall picture and the landscape, this country, even under the previous administration, was not a good place for black people. We want to talk about how bad it can be. I think because we're living through it, we don't really understand how bad it's been.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about having 2015 as a year where more black people were lynched since the 1920s, yeah. You know, that just puts it all in perspective. That was under a black president, that was under bipartisan Congress, and you had that particular dynamic take place. You had the black president put provincial protections in place for the police firing squads that were going around killing innocent black people, unarmed black people, or black people who were not reaching for their license and legal weapons, you know, at the time, and had never put the police officers in danger.
Right.
I mean,
right.
There's a climate that's currently going on that I don't think the election had anything to do with, or I don't think the election had played a part in regards to how this climate is going to transform. You know, just in my opinion, I think that as a people, we need to start galvanizing and moving and building and working together. And I think what I saw was for those who bought into the illusion of this post-racial society, or that we actually had a plate, a piece of the American pie, or that we actually had a place in this system, I think they got their wake-up call in a dramatic way. I think for the black feminists who
yeah.
were out there and lying and, you know, stating that race doesn't matter when it comes to gender, I think they got a wake-up call.
They got a real wake-up call.
Yeah, when you see between 50 and 65% of white women voted for Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, when you see those staggering numbers and you see that response, you know, white women are telling you basically that they don't put gender before race. So I think that pretty much, and I haven't seen any responses from any of the normal black feminist speaking galleries. So
right.
I haven't seen any response. So it goes without saying that, you know, a serious referendum has been issued to the black community, and that this is not our country. You know, the funny thing about the election, a lot of people thought that when all this dirt and mudslinging came out about Donald Trump, that it would hurt his chances. What they didn't understand is that when you put that type of, when you put his barbaric nature on display, when you put his asinine comments, when you put his ignorant and rude demeanor, and you place that on the platter for the public to see, what people don't realize is he himself is an extension of his community. So
right.
that didn't discourage people. You know, I mean, some people thought they, as a holding office and president, that
mm-hmm.
it's a classy position and that there's a certain amount of class and dignity that comes with that position. But what a lot of people underestimated was the fact that the white community is not a distinguished class. It's specifically the poor white community. And
mm-hmm.
they don't necessarily function from that particular dynamic. So to date, all the mudslinging, it endeared him to his fan base and his voter base. And this is why
right.
this is why he got the turnout that he did. All
right. So that's perfect, because that leads us into the Independence Day project and why this film is such an important film that's being made. And when we last talked, we were going over the 9 major areas of human activity, which are economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, sex, war, and counter-war. And the last show we covered war and counter-war, sex, religion, and politics. But because of the recent happenings with the presidential election, I want to start with politics and then go back through and go through. You kind of give us, you know, a little synopsis of what an independent community would look like within politics, law, labor, entertainment, education, and economics. So, with that being said, in your opinion, what would, and just to refresh people's memory, what does black independence look like within politics when black people are controlling their own destiny?
Well, in terms of politics with us, we would control our own candidates. But
mm-hmm.
in addition to controlling our own candidates, we would be an organized front. We would have our own hacks. We would have our own systems of government. What does that look like? That looks like having us creating our own lobbies,
mm-hmm.
us having our own think tanks, us creating our own laws and policies that we, you know, present to our representatives, that we have our own puppets, if you will, or maybe not even puppets, but we have our own financial core where we determine through our budget where our money goes and who we support. And we present and we lobby everybody
mm-hmm.
else just like most other people. Here's where our situation would differ. Those people who we put in those positions to lobby would be our emissaries. They would be our ambassadors to, you know, the system, you know, the power structure, whatever country we live in. You
right.
know, because this is not just about creating a black independent community here. This is about the whole diaspora. So those would be our embassies and ambassadors. They are our buffer zone so that we as a people don't have to engage in the day-to-day minutiae of the politics of our of this system. They're the ones who will be trained, the legal leads that will train and have on point in terms of understanding their policy. And this is why our system will flourish, because when we come together, our internal community will also be governed by community rules, and we'll have our community governed. And this is just my view of it now. Now, I'm not saying everybody on the project has shared this view, but a community or village type of leadership where we lean on the elders, but we also prompt and promote and train young brothers and sisters in those areas of leadership, of those areas of community leadership, politics, so that they'll be prepared to take the reins, and then we can pass that legacy down.
Okay. Pat, you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I ain't hear you. My bad.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Good. I just want to say, why stay with Verizon when you can save so much money by going to Sprint? I'm sorry. So, Professor.
Yes, sir.
You spoke about us having a buffer class, right?
Not necessarily a buffer class, but sort of people who are the go-between. People who go between our community, our community leadership, and however we establish that community leadership, and the wherever we are, the negotiators, they pretty much. But if we're in a particular place or particular land, whomever their emissaries are at or ambassadors are, sort of like having a diplomat and having a diplomatic class. So yeah, I guess I need to say it would be like a diplomatic class in regards to dealing with the outside community.
Okay, that's the clarity I was looking for the audience. But I have a question that's a little off the path, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. So Lincoln, like we were talking about. The importance of politics, especially in the project, mm-hmm. our vision for the future, and what we see going on now. Do you feel that people should be concerned with the fact that most people are over half of the white women in America voted for Donald Trump? And over half of the teachers of black children in America are white women.
I thought we should be concerned about that before the election. Because as we stated previously, and we talked about in previous conversations, the enemy of your community is in no position to, should never be in a position to raise or have access to your most vital commodity or your most important resource, which is our children. So, what happened with the election only confirms what we've been talking about in regards to we need to take ownership over the education for our children. We need to be, we need to have our own villages set up. We have a lot of retired brothers and sisters who can and do and will teach our children. They're willing to do it. And the same way we would pay for a private school is the way we should be able to pay and have these systems set up in our communities where we can bring people to somebody's house, somebody's basement, somebody's bedroom that's been changed into a classroom, somebody's living room that's been changed into a classroom, and start teaching our children, homeschooling and community schooling our children outside of those systems that are designed to keep us in subservience. Listen, the school system itself was in part created, the Board of Education was created because they, you know, wealthy landowners, wealthy white landowners had to find a way to control the growth, the prosperity, and progress of black minds. So this is why the school system was set up the way it was. It was because from the time of slavery, the end of slavery, 1865, to 1900, you saw a tremendous growth in black communities all across the South and the Midwest. You saw tremendous industry taking place. You saw blacks outperforming their white counterparts. And what happened with that is it created a vacuum, and it also started to go against the beliefs that were created within the white community that blacks were dumb, that blacks didn't have the mental capability to lead, that all we were good for was being subservient, having sex, and beaten down when the time came to it. So that school system was put in place to answer the Negro problem, the question, what do we do with the Negro? And that answer was put in place to create a school system to properly educate them. This is what this is their words, not mine. Properly educate them and to make sure that they will be good, productive citizens in society. Translation, we need to reform them, re-educate them, and get them back onto our plantations. You know, not the physical plantations from before, but the newly formed plantations, you know, the American grid that was forming during the Industrial Revolution. And this is why you had the school system set up the way it is. And it's been perpetuated that way ever since. Dumbing down the education, dumbing down the curriculum, so we have mindless drones in the classroom. Meanwhile, we'll put them in schools that are by highways where leaded gas was being pumped into the community, where the walls were painted with lead, and the pipes that brought the water into the school was used, the lead pipes was used to bring the water into the school. So the dumbing down process of the public school system has been in place for so long that it's just customary to us. So, yes, it is a problem having those lame white women who are a part of that same system teach our children. And this is why we need to remove them from that particular environment.
Right. And that takes us right into one of the nine major areas of human activity, which is education. So as far as what does black education look like, African education look like in the black independent community?
See, here's where I differ from a lot of the schools that have been placed out, the Afrocentric schools that placed out where, you know, children are wearing dashikis and things of that nature. I don't necessarily think we need to go that far back. I think we need to start, you know, teaching our children what's happened in the last 100 years in terms of black history, you know, what's happened post-slavery in terms of, you know, our growth in this country. I think we need to start teaching them about the towns and the communities that black people created from a historical standpoint. I also think we also need to expose them to the system of white supremacy. I was talking to a sister earlier today, and she's going to be on a project, but it was just troubling because she's an assistant principal at a high school here in Philadelphia. And she basically had to answer questions from bewildered black children who could not understand how a racist can win the presidency. You know, and it's because they have been shielded. Our community does not take white supremacy seriously. Our community does not look at it as the threat it is, even though it's been documented, publicized, and recorded over and over and over the extremes that the white supremacist power structure and the white supremacist race soldiers will go through in order to destroy our children. So we have to expose them to that system of white supremacy and explain to them how it works, what it is, and then we have to detail to them how we are to maneuver with not just within the system, but to maneuver in a way that we can, you know, propel ourselves through without this system, how we can expel this system out of our community. And those are the things we have to do. We have to empower our children with images of who they are. So when you read, when they're reading a book and they're doing a math problem, they need to see Jamal and Shaquisha, you know, walking different ways to school and who gets there first. And they need to see when you're talking about a train, a word problem that's Maddie, they need to see that the names in the word problem are black names. You know, names that we are accustomed
right.
with ourselves
right.
being named. You know, we think we have accultured ourselves with being. They need to see those things. And then, you know, the visual aspect of the school, first of all, the community needs to be the school. The school cannot be bound by four walls, especially in the southern states, in the western states, in this country, in the Midwest, South Midwest, where the temperatures allow and the climate allows for our children to be outside all year round. We need to have them involved in all of the specific skills that they're going to need to be entrepreneurs. And we need to push entrepreneurship onto our children. Will all of our children own their own business? No. But you may have four or five children in a particular sect who, once we teach them how to network with one another, will realize our skills complement one another. I'm a plumber. You're an electrician. You're a brick mason. Let's go out here, build a company up where we're building houses in our community, where we're servicing the needs of our community, so we don't have to go to the yellow pages. We can go back to the black pages and find, able-bodied workers, able-bodied handymen, handywomen who come in and take care of those things that we need done that will never go out of service. Teach our children institutions and build those institutions within our community. And teach them the skills, the necessary skill set for survival. Our children should not graduate from our particular schools without knowing how to, at some what level, deal with agriculture. Our children
right.
should not graduate from our schools without being able to utilize functional math skills. Our children should not be able to graduate from our skills without identifying who they are culturally. And I would even go a step further to say we might even need to implement a genealogy study for our children so that they can trace their roots as back as far as they possibly can. You know, as much as we can build up knowledge itself, I think
mm-hmm.
that's the most powerful thing. Empowering our children on a daily basis, showing them the 70%. We brag about being inventors. Well, it's showing them these inventions that have been created by black people and infusing that into the academics and into the curriculums.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And, last but not least, all the teachers need to be black. All the administration needs to be black. Where we get our curriculums from, those foundations must be black. And black, and not just black in color, but Afrocentric in nature, black empowering in nature.
Okay. Cool. All right, so go ahead, Pat, my bad.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because going on, huh?
Go ahead.
I'm going. You crazy, man. Man, go, man.
Go, Joe.
I'm going to karate chop you when I see you.
Silence is on the air.
Huh? All right, well, anyway, I'm going to karate chop you when I see you, but it's all good. But, all right, so the next area is law. And, you know how we like to bring our emotions and our feelings into law. So, and then independent black community, how is law laid out? How are we using law to empower ourselves?
Okay, well, see, first and foremost, with law, that sort of it goes hand-in-hand with politics. And we have to make sure that in our communities we are in control of the power structure that is delivering, you know, law enforcement, that is currently giving us, or that's providing, you know, that particular aspect, law and order in our communities. That apparatus, first of all, should be homegrown. There should not be any outsiders policing our communities. In the structures, politically speaking, we have to have our institutions powerful enough so that, financially speaking, we can control we can actually put controls in place to make sure that our politicians that we have under our thumb are seeing that the policies in our communities are serving to us.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? That means we will have police forces that answer and cater to us. We will have police oversight committees that actually have teeth that can actually, you know, review police misconduct, that review any potential hire, that takes mm-hmm. our own, you know, has our own battery of psychologists to make sure that whoever is working in the districts in our communities fit a specific psychological profile that makes them workable in our community. In addition to that, we will also, you know, we should also have a street team where we train and bring up these young brothers and sisters who are out here gang-banging and shooting each other day in, day out, where we help them to cleanse their mindset of that, of the stench of white supremacy, which allows them to see each other as their enemy. And we start to empower them. We build local community task force, local community security teams, local community. So basically speaking, these watch teams, these watchdogs that we create, these not just watchdogs, but this committee or not this group that we create will also monitor activity on the street, will also monitor police engagement on the street. Because the police need to know that they're being followed up on, that there's a follow-up to whatever they're doing. They need to know they're being watched. And if they're going to be in our communities, basically speaking, I would love it where our police, where the police officers in our community are rendered to just emergency situations. In other words, the day-to-day crime and day-to-day harassment is not a policy that they can push forth in our community, and we have to be able to politically state that if we are going up against this particular system, that we can't have that. We have to be in a position to make it where there's a consequence. And that's where our businesses and institutions follow suit and make sure that we keep that financial pressure on our politicians. And a consequence can be something as simple as, listen, to whoever the state senator is in that area, whoever the council person is, the town council person is in that area who supervises and has a supervisory committee that are over the police department, said, listen, you feel like getting elected in 2 years? Then this needs to happen. Or we got this person over here that we're going to put this money behind, and then we've given the policy to, and we're going to make sure this policy goes through. So one way or the other, we're going to have to be in direct control or even indirect control of the policy and the policymakers in regards to law and law enforcement in our community.
Okay. Yes,
so
sir.
Where do we start, though? Like, where do we start with that? What,
I can't hear you.
I don't want you to give us everything, but, like, what's step one?
Turn yourself up a bit.
Say again?
I said, where do we, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now.
Okay, I said,
where
do
we
start with that, though? And I don't want you to map out the whole entire process, but just give us step one.
Step one would be to create the think tanks, because we're not organized. Step one is to create the think tanks so that we can become organized around the specific needs in our neighborhoods and the specific needs in our community. So step one would be to create that task force, I mean, to create that think tank, for one. Step two, and I'll go three steps in.
No. You're going to reveal too much of the film. No, Jesus, stop.
All right.
But step two, you got to watch the movie.
Right, right, right.
Indeed. Indeed. But definitely that will be the step one. Step one is always the think tank organization and being organized. Because when you're organized, it eliminates the inefficient use of energy. It reinforces your mission. And basically it empowers you because you know what you're doing. And believe me when I tell you, we're going to be in that position in places where we're going to be identifying all of these areas that need to be addressed and the ways they need to be addressed and strategically address each one.
Okay. Okay. So next, the next one is labor, the activity of labor. So as far as the black community, independence in the black community, how are we using labor, or what does labor look like in the independent black community? Is there even labor?
Well, there, well, yeah, in our independent communities, hell yeah,
okay.
There's labor. All right? I mean, we spoke about it. I spoke a little bit on it earlier, and we talked about bringing the schools to the community. So let's talk about what the community will resemble in regards to labor, because that's one of the most important parts. The economics and the labor sort of go hand in hand. Now, in our communities, we have a lot of vacant space. We have a ton of vacant space. We know that our neighborhoods are being gentrified, that there's a gentrification process taking place in our neighborhoods. And, you know, so we have a lot of land to work with, a lot of buildings to work with. We also have a food shortage in our neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our communities are food deserts. One of the ideas that, you know, because I remember the factories. I'm a 70s baby, so I remember the factories. And I remember, you know, the warehouses and how the warehouses pumped, you know, the economies in our neighborhoods before the warehouses shut down and moved on to other parts of the country, and also moved into the prison industrial complex, as well as other countries around the world, such as India, China, and Mexico. So bringing that factory back to our community, we're bringing industry back to our community, but doing it in a clean way where we don't have to deal with the health effects that a lot of our elders and ancestors had to go through, which, you know, caused them cancer from asbestos, caused them, you know, cardio conditions, caused them to have cardiac conditions, caused them to have issues breathing. You know, I would like to take a lot of these warehouses and turn them into some of us will call it fisheries, some of them call hydroponics, and some places we would call aquaponics, where we start to provide food and resources for our own community, and we do so with guerrilla farming and using those processes with some of these vacant warehouses, buildings, and land. Now, where do the jobs come from? Well, if you're going to have a fishery, then you're going to need somebody that's familiar with farming fish. You're going to definitely need somebody that's familiar with that aspect of that. So you're going to need somebody who's skilled in that area. So I'm not going to say a marine biologist, but we're definitely going to need somebody who has that skill to farm and raise fish. Now, in regards to an aquaponic system or a hydroponic system, there's a lot of piping involved. There's a lot of pumps involved. There's water involved. So you're going to need plumbers. You know, and people who are trained in maintenance and dealing with, you know, how to build and construct and maintain those systems, because they're very sensitive and delicate systems, and we don't want contamination to take place. So we're going to need that. We're going to need a quality assessment in person. We're also going to need, when we talk about farming and so forth, assembly lines of people who are working within these particular building structures that we put together to produce these goods. This is food that's going to feed the community. Now, this is a store. So this is not just, you know, feeding community free of charge. No, this is a store because we need to build up an industry. We need to build an industry. Now, when you have an industry, you're going to need some security. Well, remember we were talking about earlier with the security task force, which will also be part of our labor-intensive effort. And you talk about building, taking these young brothers and sisters off the street and giving them a purpose, but also paying them, allowing them to earn a decent wage within the community, because everybody doesn't want to be an entrepreneur. Everybody doesn't want to be an entrepreneur. Some people just love to show up, do some work, and get paid. So, you know, that aspect, you know, and that's on a small scale. And, you know, when we start talking about, you know, creating industries, the principles of group economics is basically stating that it doesn't matter where you get the money from, it's where you put the money to. So all these brothers and sisters that we got out there, professional class, especially the butthurt brothers and sisters who are dealing with the, the agony of losing this election because they put all their eggs in Hillary's baskets. Well, now we need for them to start funneling some of those funds towards organizations like PACS, which has several programs, like a great mentoring program, and a lot of other programs on deck that we need to get out in the community survey program. We need to start getting those people to put forth an effort towards financing our way out of our struggle. Now, that honestly is going to be the hardest part. Because, a few weeks from now, we might still have people partying and bullshitting. Mm-hmm. Back to the norm, especially because nothing's going to change until the first week in January when the inauguration takes place.
Right.
So, people won't feel the sting of this presidential election until then. But I'm also banking on that sting when it happens. I'm banking on that because as black people, we need a serious wake-up call. And there was no more of a – this is probably the biggest Negro wake-up call to occur in my lifetime. So I believe that having Donald Trump in office will help facilitate the transition of the mindset of a lot of our brothers and sisters in regards to helping fuel and create a labor force. And like I said earlier, with the high schools and the school programs, we're not sending our children to college. We're teaching them all those skills before they leave school.
Right.
So we're not sending them off to college to earn. Exactly. So that's also part of the labor force, is that when we have our young entrepreneurial team working in the community, I mean, you build a house, you need people to carry the sheetrock, you need people to carry the wood, you need people to saw this, to place this, that, and the other, you need a demolition team, you need a whole lot of different things, and those are all included in the community plan in terms of creating labor.
Okay.
Entertainment.
We got enough entertainment. We got too much entertainment. I think, but that's again, all right, in the areas of entertainment, we need to own our own distribution. We need to change the images that we're portrayed in. We need to have power over that, and we also need to start with the children. And I say start with the children because I'm just going to say, I guess I'll keep it 100 with you brothers, you and my brothers. We talk a lot of shit when it comes to what we want versus what we really want. So in front of a crowd, we'll say we want something respectable. We want to be displayed, portrayed a certain way. We want to show black empowerment. But instead of seeing a movie like Birth of a Nation, which, okay, I'll give it, theatrical, whatever, but it does have black empowerment in the film, we'll spend our money to go see Boo. We'll go to a Madea movie where you have a 6'3" black man dressed as a woman, and he turned into a franchise. Now, I'm not mad at Tyler Perry for, earning some bread because he does support a lot of causes, but the bottom line is the imagery is confusing as hell to a child who can't decipher or articulate why is that grown man dressed like a woman and acting so damn abusive towards everybody else. So we need to do things where we have empowering images and not just, the feel-good stories. We can have action movies. We can have, hood stories. But why everybody got to get shot in a hood story?
Right.
Why do we have to have a hood story that doesn't? I mean, because you go through most neighborhoods, and most neighborhoods do not have a shootout every damn day. Most black neighborhoods, you have some, but for the majority of 95% of the black community does not experience shootouts on a daily basis. So we need to change those images, and also the distribution of those images. We need to have our own movie houses. We need to have our own theaters, our own places where we can go and have movie night and not worried about somebody trying to say that the movie is sold out when three people are sitting in the theater. We need to have access to all those things. So we need, and anytime we're ready, we can create our own movie powerhouse. I don't even want to call it Hollywood, because Hollywood is something that totally, you know, conflicted with me in terms, and it's, you know, I just don't like the idea of us mimicking or something that is so devious, you know. So, but we can definitely take control of our and we need in terms of like music, music. We have to empower positive images in music, because that's where a lot of our culture is driven. When you hear your culture, you hear the words to a beat and it's moving off and on and on and on. It can even empower you or it can destroy you by what you hear, because it's a form of hypnosis when you hear it over and over and over again. This is why we have songs that's played in our head. And the song, we heard the song twice, but now it's in our head. We can't get the damn song out of our head. It's playing in our subconscious. So we have to change that as well. And one of the things we can do is start not only promoting, but getting back to street distribution. You know, NWA was selling stuff out of their trunk. You know, rappers here in Philly were selling things out of, you know, selling CDs and cassettes out of their trunk. So we need to get back to that and stop worrying about, you know, the big payday, because when you control your own money, you know, a little bit goes a long way.
Yep.
So, and the last one is good old economics. That money, 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 that cream, cash rules everything around white people. So, what does economics look like in the black community? I mean, the black independent community. How are we using economics to help free ourselves?
Our economics would be basically creating. First of all, we have to get back to the organizational part, because we have to be able to sell to our people that buying from us is just as good, if not better, than buying from, you know, your open and declared enemy. We have to be honest with that, with in creating that particular propaganda. You know, I mean, because technically speaking, all of this is propaganda. But it's propaganda to show us that we can do things. Group economics, community economics is the key. The one thing that we have to get away from, though, is calling it Black Wall Street. Black Wall Street, and, we seem to keep thinking there was only one. There were multiple Black Wall Streets. Black Wall Street was a business district and an independent black community. Well, you had independent villages and black communities all throughout the South and the Midwest, as we spoke on earlier. They all had Wall Streets, some greater, some lesser. It was just a place where people did, merchants did trade, and they provided goods and services. Well, we can do those things in our own communities, but one of the things that I think organized-wise, and this is where the local votes come in and local politics come into place, we have to start pressuring politicians, one, to stop allowing gentrification practices to take place in our communities by utilizing block voting. And we also need to be able to create black empowerment business zones, where it's strictly in the language has to say that you have to be African American, born here in America. Let's be clear. African American, born here in America, in order to have access to these business zones, where you get preferential treatment in regards to grants, where you get preferential treatment in regards to tax exemptions, where you get allotted building space that is rent-free for a certain amount of time. These are all forms of reparations, but we can't call it reparations just yet because we're playing chess. So in getting these things, these particular business districts up and running, I'll tell you why I say Africans born in America, because you have a white African who will come to America, a white person who was born in Africa, mm-hmm. come to America and claim African-American status. And they have been able to get away with that bullshit for a long time. And this is how they get into all of our HBCUs. They get all the, you know, college grants and tuition rebates and all those different things, because they have been utilizing that system. So we have to keep the language specific, not allow for it to be vague, and we have to also make sure that the term people of color or minorities is not in any of the documentation. We are not people of color. We are black. We are Africans. You want to call us one or the other. Don't call us people of color. It's too inclusive, and all the time when you include everybody else, you normally exclude us. And we're not taking that. We're not tolerating that no more. So in these particular business districts, we will have our own businesses, and these businesses will also serve as places where our children can learn and children can be a part of the economic process in terms of empowering the village. Now, notice I said business district, not community districts. Why? Because we don't necessarily have to live in the business district that we're running and occupying. But it should be near or in our community. We don't have to necessarily be there, though. And that's important because just like if we have like a shopping mall with somebody, we buy a shopping mall, or if we have access to, you know, a community, community lot, then we won't necessarily have to live there, but our businesses will be there, our commerce will be there, so in a nutshell, that's part of it. But the biggest part is community and group economics. Now, there's just one more thing I want to touch on because I know we have to go. The idea of boycotting is terrible in our for the way that it's been used in the last few years. Boycott Walmart, boycott, Target, boycott all these big entities. We don't need to boycott them. We need to create, organize, and create black alternatives to Walmart and Target.
Right.
And then we just leave. We get all, we say, this is our stop here, and we leave. Boycotting, and I have to give Brother Patrick credit for this part, because he's one of the people that pretty much put me onto this ideal. Boycotting should only be used in the black community for black businesses, because you are boycotting businesses because you want them to improve their services so that you can come back.
Right.
Why are we trying to go back? The biggest mistake the Montgomery bus boycott did was they went back. They still gave their money to the same people. They still, when you look at that as our example, that's one of our biggest fallacies. We, and the purpose for the project, limited vision, lack of vision. The project is to promote a shared vision of an empowered, independent, protected black community. And we can't have that. We consistently go in the past, and you show us, showing at a moment of strength, and then succumbing to the same system that put us in a position to, be ostracized in the first place. We have to show our strength in leaving the plantation. When Jews get offended, they leave the plantation. When Mexicans and Latinos get offended, they leave the plantation. And every other culture, Asians get offended, they leave the plantation. We're the only ones that say, okay, well, we'll succumb and we'll come back only if you promise to treat us nice. And their fingers are crossed in front. They don't even put them behind their back. They say, we will. And then the next thing you know, we're getting shot up, we're getting killed. They're opening businesses in our neighborhoods and our communities again. So we have to change that dynamic. And that's thus the Independence Day Project.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The Independence Day Project, ladies and gentlemen, y'all better know. Like, you better know. So I mean, I'm excited about the Independence Day Project coming out. Definitely excited about being a part of the Independence Day Project myself, Patrick, and the others. It's needed. It is if. Like, today really exemplified why the Independence Day Project is needed within the black community, because we have to get to the point where we are no longer worrying about anybody else and taking care of ourselves. It's like we're only focused, like, because you and I discussed this through chat the other day, but even like what's going on with the Dakota Pipeline, we don't agree with what's going on with the Dakota Pipeline, but I'm feeling some kind of way for them calling us, asking us for help to stand with them when they've been sitting back just watching what we've been going through for the last 4 or 5 years and ain't said nothing. So that's why
even
we got
like the last 40 and 50 years.
I was just trying to be nice. You know what I'm saying? But that's an example of why we need to concentrate on us and take care of us. And this Independence Project, this Independence Day project, is going to lay it out for people so they can start imagining it themselves.
Exactly. And providing that vision and providing hope. Because the reason
right.
we go jump and help everybody else, but we don't help ourselves, is that there's a spirit of hopelessness within our struggle. And it's contagious. And we have to be careful to fight against it, because we have to, you know, understand the system of white supremacy would not exist if we weren't powerful, if we weren't
right.
about, if we didn't have an inner strength within us that makes them fear the day that we get off our knees and stand on our feet and hold them accountable. And this is why we have to push forth with this message. This is why we have to push forth with this vision. This is why we have to, because we need a code of conduct. We need to
yeah.
change it. I'm not married to the struggle. I'm married to the solutions. And the solution is the Independence Day Project. And that's why, you know, like-minded brothers and sisters like you brothers, you know, Sister Monique, Sister Carapool, you know, I got Sister Angie out here in West Philly that's going to be down with the program. You know, my brother Dave Barnes is going to be a part, you know, of I'm his co-host on the New Worldview radio show, the first Sunday every month at 900 AM WRD. And I'm also, one more announcement. Don't forget to tune in on Mondays for Office Hours with the Professor. I am going to be broadcasting through Google Hangouts 12 noon every Monday from this point forward. And we will have a lot to talk about. I'm pretty sure this Monday is going to be a very fun and entertaining show as we digest what's happened with the election, the responses, and where we're going from here. Because we don't have a
right.
choice now. We really
right.
don't have a choice. It's time to strike while the iron's hot. The iron's hot. I refuse to miss another opportunity to galvanize the minds of black people, specifically young black people, who right now feel like they don't have a leg to stand on. We need to grab those young brothers and sisters and hold on to them and pull them through. Because
right.
I'm not dealing with the bougies. I'm not. I mean, they can come aboard, but I'm not chasing them. I'm chasing these young brothers and sisters who need our assistance and need our guidance, and for us to help change their mindsets and help them understand that the illusion is over. Obama is out of office, or he'll be out of office. We no longer have to clamor to the black president that didn't have to be responsible for the black community. Now we are in a situation where we are on our own, and we will do for self, and we will succeed.
Yep. Before we go, where can people go to support the Independence Day Project? And when I say support, I mean financial support. Where can people go and donate to help the project? And how can people contact you?
Well, all of it can be done by going to my website, What About Us. It's www.wauwhataboutus.com. It's www.wauwhataboutus.com. My phone number is there. If you email, the email will actually go to Sister Andrea Defcoat, and she is currently, you know, handling that aspect of it with the crowdfund. If you go to Indiegogo, you would hashtag Black Independence or Die, hashtag Black Independence or Die, and project hashtag Project Independence. If you want to follow us on Facebook, you follow us at the Independence Day Project. You can also follow us at Professor Carl Tone Jones, the like page. You can go to my personal page, Carl Tone Jones. You can also find me, find us at the PACS page. And I'm trying to think what other sites we have to offer. But we have numerous sites. If you want to Google, go to Google Plus. You want to go to Instagram, or all those different platforms under Professor Carl Tone Jones, and make a contribution to the Independence Day Project. We really appreciate all those who've given, but we need a lot more. And we're trying to build this thing. Listen, we talk black and problem. We don't have time. You know,
mm-hmm.
put a post up yesterday with an alarm clock. It's almost midnight for us. We have to get our ish together because, you know, they're coming. And they were coming either with Hillary or not, but Hillary was veiled, and it would have caught us off guard. At least we see them coming now.
Yep. Pat, you got any parting shots?
Power to the people.
Power to the people.
Power to the people.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, hey, man, my studio artists, give it up for the professor studio artists. I know how y'all That's what's up, man. We appreciate you coming through. We're excited about the project. Everybody, support the project. Everybody, support the project. You can't, don't be out here being mad that Donald Trump president and you ain't supporting your own because you tripping. And with that being said, we're going to catch y'all next time on the Freedom Train podcast series. We will be interviewing Mrs. Swigert. I can't really say her first name, so I ain't gonna mess it up. She's an author, and we're going to profile her and learn more about her next week. But until then, y'all know how we do. Two fingers up like a player. We split them apart. We'll see you later. Thank you.